Hi. My name is Donnie Thomas, and I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. And I say that because I am more than grateful to be in recovery. It's a wonderful adventure. I'm also exceedingly grateful that I'm an alcoholic. Because without that, I would not have been guided into a group who, the members of whom are like me. I would not have had the opportunity to be presented with the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, all the literature that we read, to have had a sponsor to guide me through these steps and give me an introduction and give me some tools into a way of life that really works. I had no clue up until the time I got into AA that I didn't know how to live. I thought I was doing, well, let me put it this way. By the time I got ready to walk through the doors of AA, I had a clue then that I wasn't doing so hot. But, I mean, up until that time, I really didn't have any concept that I didn't have tools for dealing with life on life's terms. Thank God for this fellowship. Thank God for those at early, for Dr. Bob and Bill and the early AAs who went to 60 or 100 miles for a meeting, if they could find one, once or twice a week, and somehow managed to stay sober in between. And then I compare that with the meetings in the Rockville area, that we can go to a meeting any day, almost any hour, pretty close to home, and then complain about how hard it is to get sober. I was thinking, you know, our pioneers really, they set the stage. If they could do it, stay sober, give us the big book, and as the opening, the introduction to the first big book says, the purpose of this book is to tell you exactly what we did to get sober. To give us the big book, the stories, and then I complain about having a hard time trying to get sober. I thought, something's wrong here, you know. It's all it being handed to me. I read something this morning as I was reading my toasting coffee to get my day started, and it just happened to be a book review written by Gail Baldwin, and the name of it is Let's Take the Long Way Home. It's a memoir of a friendship, a very long and close friendship that she had with Caroline Knapp, who many years ago wrote, if you've read it, Drinking a Love Story. I had read Caroline's book. She eventually died of lung cancer, but she died sober, and she died as an inspiration to those around her. But I was amazed, taking one of the little excerpts from the little blurbs in the book review, read, alcoholism is the empty room in the heart that is the essence of addiction. And I really thought, you know, I didn't recognize early on that I had an empty room in my heart. But something was empty. Somewhere along the line. And I know, even before, I think, gosh, I must not have been more than 12, when I really had thoughts of, I want to drink. Now, I didn't grow up in an alcoholic environment. We didn't have booze sitting around. I grew up in North Carolina, down on the coast, crossroads. We had a stoplight, but that was because we needed to get to the other side of Highway 70. And that's the only reason we had us. That was our opportunity. That was, you know, we could make a run for it when that stoplight. But it was a little, very small town. The sort of place in LaGrange, you simply didn't, well, you didn't have cocktails. You just didn't do it. You didn't drink with other people. You didn't drink in front of people is what I'm getting at. If you were going to drink, you had to keep your liquor in your glove compartment of your truck and do it by yourself. But I didn't grow up seeing people drink. I don't recall ever seeing my father drunk but once. That was on my 16th birthday. He definitely had the ism, but I didn't see the alcohol growing up. It was not until later, after I'd been in this program for a while, that I found out that, let's see, his mother had 11 children, and out of the 11, only two were not alcoholic. Two had died an alcoholic death. One of my uncles had stopped drinking after an automobile accident, but he was when he stopped drinking, he became very closely involved in the church. The other uncle stopped drinking after an automobile accident. He did not become involved in the church. He was just a miserable old man. He kept things, a very small community, and he'd keep things stirring all the time. All the time. You know, it's kind of like it would have been better for everybody around him if he just had a drink occasionally. You know? But that was the kind of way it was. But I know early on, I thought this would be really cool if I could just drink a little bit. And I'd read somewhere that alcoholics, if you can't get booze anywhere else, you drink vanilla. Mom has some vanilla. I'm going to try it. And I did. And it was horrible. If that stuff had tasted anywhere near as good as it smells, I might have started off on a little toot my first time around. But that didn't kill that desire. You know, and I remember reading, I think it's Omar Khayyam, the prophet, the loaf of bread, a jug of wine, and thou. And I remember focusing on the loaf of bread and the jug of wine, and you're on your own. But I did. I think I had a glass of wine, maybe when I was 14. I thought it was delightful. I wanted more, and I couldn't have it. And then a cousin got married. I got to be in the wedding. And at the reception, I was told you can have two drinks of something, rum and coke, something, daiquiri maybe. And I did, and I thought it was delightful, and that's all I could have. And then they sent me away to girls' school. And, of course, the first thing that the old lady, well, it was full of old maids. And it was only girls, and everything had, you know, it was very structured. So, and they said, you know, please, you must, when you go out, we had to wear, well, we couldn't wear pants anywhere. We had to wear skirts, but we always had to wear white gloves. And then if you go out on dates, you cannot have more than two drinks. Because, they weren't worried about our health, but they didn't want us to get drunk and do something that would make St. Mary's look bad. You know, that's the only reason. So finally I escaped from there, and I went to Chapel Hill. And they didn't have any restrictions at Chapel Hill. I could take the classes I wanted to at the time I wanted to, and I could date, and I was just full of all these guys. You know, I thought, oh, I'm in heaven. But then I met a guy at Chapel Hill who drank the way I wanted to. And naturally, we found each other and all those thousands of students. We pretty much drank our way. The first year I was at Chapel Hill, I flunked out of school. I had gone there I had decided I was going into medical technology. Not that I necessarily had any clue what medical technology was about, but it sounded good. So the first semester, I signed up for things like organic chemistry, which was like a six-hour course. I took Russian history, and I had another chemistry, like a qualitative analysis chemistry course. I mean, just, come on. I was a valedictorian in high school. I can do this stuff if you go to class. Well, my social life interfered with my classwork and my labs, and so I dropped the classes and just went on with the social life, which proceeded just full steam ahead, and I got an A in social life and a D in my classes, and I had to sit out a year. But I went back and I did graduate with a degree in English. I got a little bit more down to earth than what I was capable of doing. But this fellow and I, we got married. And I remember thinking at the time, we pretty much partied our way through the Duke Woods and the Citadel, and I was telling you, we had the way we would, you know, we had football games at Carolina. Everybody dressed up, and you took your booze to the game. I mean, that's what you did. And we'd dress all up, and we'd go to sit in the bleachers, Keenan Stadium, and we always took a fifth. And I remember that there were guys in the fraternity who would date, and a couple of them would get together and say, "You want to split a pint for the weekend?" And we used to laugh at them. Split a pint? Our fifth would be gone by the third quarter. You know, I mean, that's just the way we drank. And we'd go to the Citadel. I was telling you, we took road trips, first one place and then the other. But the way we measured how we were going, if we went to the Citadel, it depended on how many people were going to be in the car and how fast they drove. Because it could be, if we went really fast, there were only two of us, and it was a 2-case trip. But if four of us went down there, and the guy was driving 65, it might be a 4 or 5-case trip. You just never knew about these things, you know, so we always had to plan ahead. But I just went right into that life. It was just wonderful. Just fit right in. But it took that first a few drinks beforehand to make me fit in, because once I sort of had a couple of drinks, that empty room in my heart felt like it filled up a little bit, and that invisible shield between me and the rest of the world dropped, and I stopped feeling like the square peg in the round hole. Felt like I, you know, fit that space a little bit better, and I felt a little more comfortable in my own skin. And I could speak brilliantly, you know, just carry on. Tell wonderful jokes, that kind of thing. It made me feel good. It made me feel different. It made problems kind of shift to the background. And as long as that lasted, as long as I got that effect, that was pretty good. The guy and I married, which is generally what a couple of drunks do. You discover each other and get in the habit of one another and not having any other plans at the time. We just got married. Well, we had to. I didn't want to go back home to LaGrange. And it wasn't so much that I was hot to get married, but back then you couldn't just pick up and go live together someplace. It was much more complicated. And we wanted to move up to the Washington area, and his parents were up here. So we knew that we had to be married if we moved up here, so we got married. And I know then that I didn't have very much of a goal, except I wanted to get out of LaGrange. And I didn't mind if we kept on doing what we were doing. We moved up to the Washington area, got an apartment in Alexandria, and pretty much, we did a lot of socializing with his parents. And that kind of socializing was the come over for dinner. We'll have drinks before dinner. And, you know, some wine with dinner. Maybe we'll have some after dinner drinks. Basically, what it was from the time you hit the door, you were drinking until the time you went home. And then, of course, on vacation, if we went with his parents, his dad had the theory that the sun was across the yard arm somewhere in the world. So we started with Bloody Marys at 11 o'clock in the morning. It didn't matter. But that was the sort of environment. Plus, it was his dad. It was my father-in-law that taught me about martinis. And the three of us sat in a bar, I remember, soon after we got into Washington. And Ralph decided I needed to know about martinis. Now, I was doing okay along that time with just scotch. I hadn't even thought about the martini thing. But you have to know how to drink martinis. Well, I learned that you have to drink martinis with an attitude, or they will really do a job on you. But anyway, at this particular time, it was just Jack and his dad and me. And we started, I don't know, maybe it was probably 2 o'clock in the afternoon that we started drinking martinis. And and Ralph did teach me how to drink martinis, but unfortunately, by the time I had learned, all three of us were just pie-eyed. And we had driven the car to the bar, but all of us were not a single one of us was sober enough to drive home. Now, we had to get a taxi to go back to the apartment. where Jack's mother, my mother-in-law, was. But we didn't want, now, I love this, but we didn't want her to know that we had been drinking. Okay? So we left the car at the bar, we took the, got out of the cab, walked in, I'm sure we all walked in perfectly straight into the apartment and carried on conversations without slurring our words once. I mean, why, I can't think now why we'd ever think we could pull the wool over our eyes. I mean, she lived with her husband all those years. I mean, the lady was not stupid. But that was just the kind of stuff. That was the kind of stuff we did. And I can remember, and it might have been, I can't remember the time I'd been off with these two characters before and had martinis. But I was just, because I was new in the area, I was going to see my internist for the first time, sort of an introductory visit and what have you. And we'd had lunch, that's right. Met Jack for lunch, we had a few drinks for lunch, went off to see the doctor, got into the doctor's office, and we chatted a bit. And then she was, you know, she does the thing with the hammer on the knees and looked at my ears. Then she took that little light, she was looking in my eyes. She said, Said you had martinis for lunch, didn't you? Well, I was just so impressed. You can tell that from looking in my eyes? She said, of course not. I can smell your breath. It was also the same doctor about 20 years later that I showed up for a regular appointment. Only I'd been drinking from since 5:30 in the morning because that's what I did. I got up at 5:30 to get lunches together and breakfast ready so my daughters could get on the school bus. The first thing I do is go downstairs, pour my scotch in my coffee cup. Like nobody could tell I was drinking scotch, right? Because it doesn't have any smell. Start my day. And this particular day, after I got the kids off, Jack had gone to work, went over to Fairfax, as a matter of fact, to see Dr. Lumpkin. Only this time, I had liquor in my breath. She had done some blood work. And this time, my liver functions were out of whack. My triglycerides were out of whack. And she looked at me straight in the eye, and she said, Donnie, you're an alcoholic. You've got to get some help. Now, this was after a few years of, after we'd moved into the area, I'd had a couple of babies. We moved out to Burke, Virginia. And about that time, I started going to health fairs because they had a lot of them in Fairfax County. Because somewhere in the back of my mind, I thought I might have a drinking problem. People who don't have drinking problems never are concerned about whether they have a drinking problem or not. And they don't go off to health fairs, use another name, so you can get the blood test to see what's going on with your blood. Because if your liver functions are all right, I figured if my liver functions are all right, that was permission to keep on the way I was going. But this time, Dr. Lumpkin, my time had run out. But I'd also spent a few years overseas with my husband. We lived in Jordan. We lived in Bangladesh. Got to Calcutta. Lived in Nicaragua. You know, the jewels of the world. Actually, I loved every place we ever lived. It was, the people were delightful. I don't know how I managed to get through these places and take care of my kids, drinking the way I did, and still make it out somewhat intact to finally encounter Dr. Lumpkin again. But I had learned somewhere along the line that I'd started drinking pretty badly before we went overseas that really took off there. I found that liquor, after it stopped being so much fun and felt so good, that it took the edge off. It was like an anesthetic because the marriage wasn't going too well. And I guess if we could keep drinking and live sort of an isolated life, it would be better than if we had to work on relationships, participate in relationships. And I'm not trying to portray myself at all as a shining example of the dutiful wife who I've always presented well, because whatever I did, I never hid my drinking, unfortunately, for my family. It would have been nice if I had. But I stumbled on this little formula that if I'm at a party and I know I've had too much to drink, I would say, I'm an alcoholic, you know. Whoever it was I was talking to would always say, oh, you poor thing. That gave me permission to drink. So I could keep drinking. And it worked really well for a long time until you hit those days when, and I know you know what I'm talking about, when the day comes and your eyes open and I'd say, oh God, I've got to do another day. And I'm not really excited about sleep, about waking up that morning. It would be a lot nicer at that point in life if I just not awakened. But when you have children and a husband, it's not an option. So, okay, got to do the day. Well, the way I do the day, and knowing full well, is, you know, we say in here, we do the same things over and over, expecting different results. I never expected a different result. I knew from the time my eyes opened in the morning, my feet had to hit the floor, that before the day was over, I'd be drunk again, just because that's what I did. Get up, start the booze at 5:30, you know, kind of maintain, except for those times. Like the one night that I had to pick my husband up from the metro, and the way we had to get there was a sort of dark, windy, not very well-lighted road. In this particular night, it was snowing, and driving was really poor. I had both of my kids in the car, and I was drunk. So on the way to the metro, my older daughter, who was riding shotgun, had to tell me whether to steer a little bit to the left or a little bit to the right to stay within the lines. Now, there was oncoming cars. My younger daughter was in the back seat being very quiet. We got to the metro, and comes Jack walking around to my side of the car, opened the door, looked at me, and he says, you're drunk again, aren't you? Yeah. Only this time, for some reason, it got through to me what I'd just done with my daughters. It wasn't so much that I had a near miss in that car, but I couldn't imagine what it must have been like for them, for Jillian to have sat beside me in the front seat of the car, having to tell me where to drive. Kinsey must have been terrified in the back seat. And I had driven drunk regularly with him in the car. It was just this particular night, maybe it was just that confluence of circumstances, that it finally hit me. What the hell are you doing here? What are you doing? Where are you in all of this? And I'll tell you, there were some times even when we were overseas that I thanked God for booze, because it kept me at times from blowing my brains out. It would keep me just numb enough to what was going on in the marriage that I did get through the days. Maybe not well, but I got through until I got back to the States. And we came back in 85. And I drank through 85. And at the beginning of 86 is when I went to see my doctor again. I did go to a couple of AA meetings. I called AA, and here's the deal about this thing. Somewhere along the line, I knew that AA would work. We had had a friend, my former husband and I had a friend early on in our marriage who had, he was a lawyer, he was the counsel for the American Manufacturers Association, had a very powerful position in Washington. He had a lot of fingers and a lot of pies. And unfortunately, Joel also had a drinking problem. that led to his being fired as the lawyer of the American AMA, and kind of his fingers were cut off these pies that he had, and he went downhill, the classic decline. And I remember Jack and I were so distressed over this. He got to the point where, when it took 2 or 3 years finally for him to get to the point, he tried to shoot himself. Unfortunately, the shells that he was using for the shotgun were so old they didn't fire when he pulled the trigger. So he burned his throat really badly, and they put him in Arlington Hospital. And our question was, why don't you go to AA? Well, that's what, I mean, we'd seen the movies. I'll Cry Tomorrow, Come Back, Little Sheba, you know, Days of Wine and Roses. So I knew about this. He said, well, I'm one of the trues of Tennessee. The trues do not go to AA. So instead of coming to AA, he blocked his exhaust pipe in the car and asphyxiated himself, which was, he thought, an alternative to AA or recovery. 20 years later, maybe not 20 years later, Timothy, I had driven drunk with my kids in the car. My little jig was up. You reach a point when, be damned if you do and be damned if you don't. I don't want that drink and I can't not take that drink. And I didn't know at the time that I had a choice. So I maintain even now, if you don't know you have a choice, you don't have a choice. You have to keep doing what you're doing until you find out another way to do it. But I knew that I couldn't keep drinking, and I didn't know how to not drink. I did go to maybe 3 or 4 AA meetings, but what I wanted to make the point of here. I called the desk down in D.C., told them that I had a drinking problem, and they said, fine, give us your address. We will send somebody to take you to a meeting. And I thought that sounded really, really good. So I gave them the address, and of course I'd had to sort of have a couple of drinks to work up my courage to be able to do this phone call. Anyway, so that was fine. Whoever they sent was coming that night to pick me up at 8 o'clock. Now, I was kind of hopeful. I thought, you know, this would be wonderful if she really shows up. I mean, come on. Somebody coming out, didn't know me from Adam's house cat, going to pick you up at 8 o'clock when you should have been home with your, you know, kick your shoes off, watch TV, something like that. Sure enough, of course, I'd had a couple of drinks to prepare for this meeting, too. Sure enough, at 8 o'clock, this lady picked me up. And I was, number one, I was just astounded that she was there. God, she really showed up. Did not say one word about the fact that I smelt like a Scotch distillery. Handed me a big book, went to a meeting. And I remember I can't remember what was said at the meeting, but I remember when we got in our circle after the meeting to hold hands, I felt like I wasn't worthy to hold the hands of the people on either side. That's how low I felt. That's how low I thought of myself as being at that time. And it's probably just as well, because a lot of that feeling is what drove me. I knew that I wanted to get sober. And I was having a hard time doing it because my husband was still drinking and he didn't want me to get sober. I was his drinking partner. And I was very... He could push me around. He had the power. So if I got sober, things were going to change. And that wasn't going to work out so well. I finally figured out, all by myself, that maybe if I could get in a rehab for maybe 28 days, get away from him long enough to get established, maybe that might work. So I called again. guys. Had a couple of drinks. And called Melwood Farm, not too far from us, where I live in Rockville, or in Montgomery Village. And apparently, I don't know who I talked to or whatever, but I wanted to get in. And the lady called me. She said, well, I have to check with your insurance. She checked with my insurance. She called me back. She said, well, the people at the insurance company don't think you're an alcoholic based on our conversation. Well, between the time I talked to her the first time and the time that she called me back, I'd have time to have a couple of more. And so I said, what do you mean I'm not an alcoholic? Give me her name and her telephone number. And I'm not entirely certain what I said to the representative from Aetna Healthcare. It was something along the lines of having paid money for a lot of years, and now when I really need it, you're not going to let me have it. Do you know that the papers would eat this up? It was something so outrageous. Anyway, I don't think that telephone call lasted much longer, but I hung up. About 2 minutes later, the lady from Melwood called back and said, you're in, pack your bags. Naturally, I said, but I can't go today. I don't want to go until Saturday. I think that was 2 or 3 days away. I can't remember now. But anyway, it gave me time to... I had so much confidence in my husband at this point in my life that I made I called a friend in Michigan City, Indiana, that had been overseas with us, arranged for my children to stay with her while I was in rehab, got them on the airplane. We were ready to go, and poor Jack never had a word to say about it. I mean, I wasn't going to leave them there with him. I figured they got to have at least one responsible adult in their life, so we shipped them off to Peggy. Anyway, I remember he drove me to Melwood Farm that Saturday morning. Now, I guess Thursday afternoon I may have still had some scotch left, which my daughters, bless their little shitty hearts, poured out. The only thing left in the house, I think, was creme de menthe. And I mean, really, I am an alcoholic, right down to the very marrow of my bones, but I swear I couldn't drink that creme de menthe. This is just as well. Went into, got to Melwood, and I remember the feeling of getting out of the car, thanking Jack very, thank you for driving me over here. How nice of you. Got my little valise, walked up to the doors, walked through those doors. It was like sliding into home base just seconds ahead of that ball and getting called. Safe! Yes. And that was the beginning. That was the beginning. I felt like, thank God I'm here. Because I knew in my heart of hearts that that's really where the answer was. I just had to find out how to fill up that empty room that I had. And so, that was the beginning. And one of the first things... Now I'm going to do something you all love. I'm going to read to you. We started the next morning with the 24-hour day book. And as luck would have it, the page we read first was, thought for the day. Keeping sober is the most important thing in my life. The most important decision I ever made was my decision to give up drinking. I am convinced that my whole life depends on not taking that first drink. Nothing in the world is as important to me as my own sobriety. Everything I have, my whole life, depends on not taking that first drink. Can I afford ever to forget this even for 1 minute? Now, that was the first piece that I was introduced to in AA. And I remind myself of this all the time. All the time. My priority is staying sober, because my relationship with my group, my relationship with my daughters, my relationship with my very best friends in the whole world, who drove hundreds of miles from Rockville down here to Madison, Virginia, while I was speaking, all my relationships depend on not taking that drink. I can't go back to where it was. But the most important thing is my relationship to me. depends on not taking that first drink. Because getting introduced to that passage, and then the passage in the 24-hour day book that tells us about the mosaic as we approach some of the problems in sobriety, that each of our problems are a part of our own life's mosaic. But every single one has a place, and we're not going to have the complete picture without all those little pieces of stone. Just as we fit into the whole mosaic in our own little way, in whatever life's pattern is. That, to me, it made sense. And I knew, I think for the first time in my life, I really had a goal, and my goal was to get sober. I wanted to be sober. Whatever it meant, and I wasn't entirely certain what that was, whatever happened, whatever was to come, I wanted to be sober. And that was just, in Melwood was the beginning. And of course we were introduced to the steps. I think probably I walked through those doors on the third step. Because I'd known for years I was alcoholic. I had no doubts about my powerlessness. I lived in a scotch bottle, for God's sakes. I couldn't get out of a scotch bottle. What did I have power over? I knew that a power greater than me had to do something. Because I had no power. And I knew, I think walking through those doors, I really may have made the decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of, as it turns out, AA in the beginning. And that was just the beginning. I went to meetings, started going to meetings after I got out of Melwood, collected my children. As an aside to this, you know, to this day, my kids had seen me drunk. I was not a nasty drunk. I loved to drink. I didn't drink anything except Creme de Menthe and Dubonnet that I thought really tasted like panther piss. But, you know, other than that, everything was wonderful. And I didn't beat my kids. I didn't do anything like that. They have never, in all these years, ever said anything to me of a negative, never made a negative statement about my behavior when I was drinking. They have never hit me over the head with that night when they were terrified to be in the car with me. They were so delighted that I was in an organization that I was taking classes and how not to be a drunk. It was, please, Mom, go to your meeting. You know, and even now sometimes they'll come home to visit, and if I'm not on my P's and Q's, they'll say, did you go to a meeting today, Mom? It's none of your business. I'm still the mother, and there's nothing you can do about it. But we have a very good relationship. But I think a lot of... See, now I'm going to have to sing or something because I lost my train of thought. Or talk among yourselves for a second. I'll see where I happen to. Oh, I know what I forgot. As we share the phenomenon of craving and the fact that we have to come to AA to get honest with ourselves, and along with getting honest with ourselves. And, you know, even coming into the fourth step, I thought I didn't do it according to the book because I read the big book and I couldn't understand it. The thing about the columns and Mrs. Brown and Mrs. Green just didn't get it for me. I would not penetrate. Nothing was going on up here. Flat line. But I did an autobiographical fourth step. And it was, at the time I did it, my very best effort. It was the best I could do at the time I did it. And my intent there was I had been to a meeting. I'd been going for a couple of years, and I was still trying to do the third step perfectly before I went on to the fourth step. And there was a little guy who used to go to meetings, Wink, who had said, the step states that we make a fearless and thorough moral inventory. And if you are fearless and realize that this step is for you, and you're honest with yourself, He said, there's nothing you're going to encounter that is going to make you drink. He said, just be open. Open your mind. Open, this is for you. And I thought, you know, I've got to get this for a step done because I am so afraid I'm going to take a drink. Went home, got my yep legal pad and the pencils that had to be just sharpened just right and maybe a couple of pens. Not the medium point, not the broad ones, but just the fine, you know, they have to be the right pens too to write this thing. And sat down and wrote out the fourth step. That which is okay, but my sponsor actually took her time and set aside some time for me, which I was pretty impressed with too. I said, God, you know, she's going to listen to me talk about this stuff, and we did. And I remember thinking that I could trust her with what I was saying. And she listened, and she had comments. She would comment about, you know, but it was mostly encouraging things that she was saying. And I know that after having done the fifth step, I walked back the next day into my regular meeting, and I felt pretty comfortable in AA before. But there is, to me, there was an imperceptible difference in the way I felt after I'd done that fifth step. I was a belonger. And Patty and Karen and Lynn have heard this 1,000 times before. A couple of years before, I had gone to, the family had gone to Tortola, British Virgin Islands, for a vacation. It's a very small little place. You've got to take the ferry to get over to the island. But the way it's set up when you go through customs, which is a space about a third of the size of this room, and they have, you know, tourists or, you know, people who are coming through, the travelers. And then on this side, they have a special little window, and it's labeled in somebody's hand on a piece of board, and it says, and this side is for belongers. Okay? The next day, I went to my meeting, and I entered on the side for the belongers. You know, I sat down, and it was like, I really, really am glad I'm here. I belong. I had made a commitment to this program. I mean, a real, honest, gut commitment. I wanted to be sober. I wanted to be what I saw in the people around me. And I had gotten to the point also in the program of being, we come in with trust issues. I was part of, but kind of, I want to keep you kind of out here. Not too close. I don't want you to get too close to me. And I've got a little bit of time. But that sort of put me in the position, I don't want to be standoffish anymore. I want to be a part of. I want to know the people in AA that I sit next to every day. And after having, I'll have to tell you, the sixth step for me was, I was still not entirely ready to give up all my character defects. To my sponsees today, I said, it doesn't matter whether you feel entirely ready or not. Don't waste the time. Do the sixth step. Say the seven-step prayer. Get on with the program because you're going to keep coming back around again and again, and it's going to get better. The understanding will be deeper. We will begin to see ourselves differently. Eventually, we're going to, what? No serenity? Peace? I had wanted peace of mind my whole life. And I got it in AA, and I had it for a long time before it finally consciously occurred to me that I was serene. And it still just brings tears to my eyes. And I thought, somewhere along the line, I had stopped at that phenomenon of craving. I had begun to get the promises before I was halfway through. How could I ever tell you how much I love this program? I don't think any of us are sitting in here tonight who don't, or who wouldn't be sitting in here, you know. But there's always, there is something in our literature. There's something in our big book. This whenever something is disturbing to me, it's because I have a problem. Acceptance. If I find something wrong with people, places, things, institutions, whatever, until I accept, I can't get beyond it. And today, the guiding force is, number one, it's pretty much, I do pretty much the same things that I did in the beginning. I start the day with a prayer. Some days it's better prayers than others. And some days I actually remember what I was praying for before, you know, I'm the process of getting to work, depending on how the traffic's going. But I read my literature. And I read it over again because I forget. And I need to be reminded. And I have to go to meetings because I need to hear somebody else remind me of the principles. Because sometimes the selective alcoholic brain that I have will remember what I want to remember but forget the pieces that are a little bit troubling if I would like to be right this time. You know? I still talk to my sponsors. And I don't pick up a drink. I don't pick up that drink. And the reason I don't pick up that drink is not because my life is just trouble-free. It's because I try so hard to keep a spiritual, that spiritual connection with my higher power. My whole, that whole, again, we can do on a daily basis what we can't do on a two-daily basis. I can do something for 24 hours I can't do for 25 hours. And my whole sobriety is dependent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition and my relationship with my higher power. Dina was reading, just preparing last night, and I read, happened to pick out a couple of page, sentences in the 11th step, because I usually talk about the unshakable foundation for life that we find in here. And it actually is prayer and meditation in conjunction with our relationship with our power, provides us with an unshakable foundation for living. And then, of course, we take all we have, take all this 11th step, put them all together, and we get into the 12th step and practice these principles in all our affairs. You know, we stay sober and try to pass the message on to other alcoholics. And yet it gets... After talking an hour, I still think of all the things that I've left out about the quality of the program, I mean, and the quality of life. It just gets better for me every day. I love to take this program into work with me. I take it in my heart. I'm not too far away from something in this program every single day. And I keep, you know, you meet people and you think, you know what? If you went to AA, you'd have a lot fewer problems. And if you're not an alcoholic, I know how you can get to be one. That's the only entry ticket you need, you know? It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure. I was telling Patty earlier when we were getting ready to come down here, talked to Billy Call yesterday morning and said, we must have talked half an hour, so I don't know how long it was, actually. I said, you know, we talked about AA, and I felt like I had known him all my life. I could have grown up in Madison with a familiarity, but that's just the way it is. I go into a meeting, no matter where, and there are no strangers there. I may not know the names of all my friends yet, but there are no strangers there because we're all alike. We've all been through those not comfortable in our own skin. We've all been through the despair of not wanting to pick up that drink. And then having to pick it up anyway. I mean, just to be somebody to tell me that I had a choice not to pick it up was, that was just phenomenal to me. And I will have to tell you, too, that after having gone to several meetings and hearing about the higher power, and we can develop our own concept of a higher power, I had to hurry home after the meeting that night, and I told my dear husband, guess what? I have a higher power, and you're not it. And I was so excited. And I still have a higher power that I'm not sure I have a greater understanding even now. But I know that whether my higher power needs me or not, I need my higher power. And I call my higher power God, because it says a lot in just a three-letter word. But it's what keeps me going. It's what keeps me sober, along with this program and the wonderful AAs in it. And I thank you for letting me ramble on to you tonight. And thank you for not getting up and walking out.